Chapter 20. Having an RV helped. We still needed to carefully plan the logistics, and it wasn't easy. Smythe had been working with Sims, and some problems remained. Serious problems.
Sir, even with the RV getting us most of the way there, we still have the problem that we can't carry enough food both to get us to the scavenger base and back here.
No, I said. But we can lessen the problem if we only need food enough to get there, I explained, and we don't plan to come back.
Sir?
After the assault, we're not walking all the way back here. There's no point. And if that Kristang ship shows up early while we're walking out in the open, we'll be totally exposed. And what we're going to do is, after the attack, we hole up here. I zoomed the map out and scrolled to the west of the scavenger's base. There are caverns here, in these hills. They're cramped, and it's going to be uncomfortable. This site is 70 kilometers west of the scavenger's base. We'll be closer to it on our way in. I think we may stop there and drop off any supplies we don't need for the assault, before we launch the attack. Smythe tapped his iPad, examining the caverns I'd mentioned.
That could work. I've holed up in worse places, in the mountains of Afghanistan. We still won't have enough food. We won't be able to carry enough food to get to the scavenger's base if we're going to be hauling armor with us.
That will not be a problem, I said with a wink. I know a place that delivers. Tapping the transmit icon on my Z phone, I called the Flying Dutchman.
Hey, is this Skippy's Pizzeria?
Okay, sure, I'll play along.
His voice changed to a stereotypical New York accent.
Yeah, this is Skippy's Pizza. What can I do you for?
Do you deliver?
Depends. You's got a coupon or something?
Seriously, Skippy? We need a delivery of food and medical supplies, the first aid stuff we brought from Earth, not the fancy nano gizmos that we don't know how to use. I explained how we planned to get to the scavenger's base by driving the RV, then on foot. And by food, I mean sludges, dehydrated. We need maximum nutrition and minimum weight and volume. Can you send a couple shipments down to us?
Ah, sure, no problem. It's not like I'm busy.
You moron, I'm building a freaking starship out of moon dust up here. I know you're extremely busy. We can't carry enough food with us to reach the scavenger's base, not with all the weapons and gear we need for the assault. Can you put together something simple to drop supplies to us? It will have to be capable of a soft landing. Oh, and it has to stay out of sight of the Kristang here. We can't have them seeing a contrail coming in, or parachutes.
Simple? Something simple. To fly all the way across a star system, enter the atmosphere without leaving a contrail the Kristang could see, and land a package without damaging it.
Simple, he says.
Yeah. Can you do that?
We don't need the first shipment today. We'll need it probably a couple days, maybe a week, before we reach their base. I sent our timeline to you.
I'm supposed to drop everything I'm doing up here, Skippy complained, to design, test, and build a drone delivery system from nothing.
It's kind of important, Skippy. Unless, you know, you don't want us to recover that AI for you. Or you have a better idea.
Damn it. I've been trying to think up a better idea while you've been blabbering on, and no, I don't have a better idea.
Crap.
All right, fine. Yes, I can put something together to deliver supplies to you. Maybe I'll get lucky and it will land on your stupid monkey head.
Excellent. Knew I could count on you, Skippy.
All I can say is there better be a huge freaking tip for this delivery.
Yep. I decided to push my luck. If the delivery is late, do we get it for free?
With the food situation temporarily solved by Skippy's Pizzeria, we turned our attention to other logistical issues.
Captain Smythe, I said, I need you to plan the route from here to the scavenger base, especially the route for driving the RV.
Skippy already mapped out the fastest route. He tapped his iPad and the screen showed Skippy's suggested route. Also, two alternatives. Two more lines appeared on the screen. One slightly shorter and one that stretches out the caravan's power to get us the furthest before we have to get out and walk. Being British, he called our salvaged vehicle a caravan instead of the American term RV.
Smythe, I said, I'm sure Skippy has mapped out mathematically perfect routes, and we can't hope to improve on that. However, I know that little shithead beer can, and one variable he won't include in the billions of calculations he ran is anything practical. Fastest, shortest, and, stretchiest are all fine in theory. What we need is the route that gets us to the scavenger base by the target date with the least risk. For example, on this route here,
I tapped the shortest line. Skippy's plan takes us straight through this big swamp. Sure, the RV can supposedly crawl or swim through a swamp. And what happens if a tread gets stuck, or a pontoon gets punctured, or a motor burns out and the RV is stuck in a swamp? Then we might have to walk out of the swamp, carrying all our gear and freezing cold water over our heads. And we can't take that risk. Skippy won't take that sort of possibility into account. He also won't consider that we're inexperienced drivers, so he may plan a route that takes us along a narrow cliff. Got it?
Yes, sir, Smythe said, looking chastened.
Wow, for the first time, I felt like a real officer. Smythe called me over the next morning. He pinged me while I was helping Sims load supplies into the RV. I took a welcome break and went into the cavern to where Smythe was working in a tent, a heated tent. It felt good to step inside and unzip my jacket.
What do you have, Captain? I asked.
Several possible routes for us to reach the scavenger's base within 30 days with minimal risk, we think.
He pulled up the first of three routes on his iPad and explained how the route avoided as much as possible swamps, driving across mushy ice fields and steep terrain where the RV might slide down or tip over.
After we cross this river, we should have enough power left to get here. These grasslands are relatively flat and dry. We'll have to walk from there. The good news is we'll only need to detour 40 kilometers to go around this swamp, and once we're past that, it's a straight shot and... Well, Bob's your uncle, we're there.
Bob's my uncle. Neither of my three uncles was named Bob. Smythe chuckled.
It's an expression, sir. It means it's easy.
Oh. Bob's your uncle, huh?
Yes, sir.
Show me the other alternatives. He did. Each of the three possible routes had advantages. The first didn't get as far before the RV ran out of power. Its advantage is the walking part was over easy terrain. The second route stretched out the RV's power cells to cover the maximum distance, minimizing the distance we would have to walk. However, the walking route went through a region of hills and one swampy area. And the third route took the absolutely safest path for the RV, minimizing the possibility it would get stuck somewhere, and the walk would be through relatively flat, easy terrain. The disadvantage was the walking section of the route was the longest of the three alternatives.
All the routes require we cross these three rivers?
Yes, there's no way around them, literally, Smythe explained. We mapped the easiest crossings we can get to along the route, where the river current is slowest. Here, for example.
He pointed to the first river crossing, which was the same on all three alternatives. The three routes diverged after that.
If we cross up here instead, the river is only half as wide. However, your chap Skippy tells me the current is more than twice as fast in this area, and there are large rocks just under the surface. Down here, where we plan to cross, the current is more manageable, and the river bottom is sand. There are no underwater obstacles the caravan could get stuck on.
I nodded.
Makes sense.
Good work.
The sticky point is that last river. This nasty bugger here.
He tapped the iPad screen for emphasis.
It's going to be a problem. The glacier that feeds this river is breaking up quickly. There are large chunks of ice floating in the river. We'll need to steer around them. The river channel is narrow almost the whole way down to the sea. It would be hundreds of kilometers out of our way to find an easier crossing. And the riverbanks are steep. The only place we can see for a crossing is here. The bank on the far side is less than half a meter tall. Skippy tells us the caravan treads can climb that easily. And by the time we get there, with the summer coming on, the river level should be higher as the glacier melt accelerates. The bank is steep on this side. We'll need to create a ramp down into it. Lots of work with picks and shovels. Nothing the lads can't handle.
He made it sound easy. Maybe the spec ops types hacking out a ramp large enough for an RV to drive down was a fun couple hours in the great outdoors. Right then I had an idea.
Captain, we can use armor to clear a ramp. With those suits, it won't take long at all.
Do we want to use the suits for this, sir? We'd need to recharge the suit's power cells from the caravan. That will drain the caravan faster.
Not such a good idea after all. I was still thinking of what was now the good old days, when we had nearly unlimited power from the Dutchman's reactors. That mindset needed to change fast, before I made a stupid mistake and got people killed.
You're right.
Saw muscles are a problem we can deal with more easily than draining power from the RV. We need to be very careful with the RV's power cells. Route 2, I think, is out. I don't want us walking through those hills. The extra gravity, the low oxygen level, and the heavy loads we'll be carrying will make the hike tough enough already. Route 3, you say, is the least risk for the RV, but the walk is longer. How much longer?
An additional 60 kilometers. Roughly a day and a half, sir.
He didn't point out that information was clearly displayed on the side of the map. I should have noticed that. 60 kilometers was to Captain Smythe of the British Special Air Services a trek of a mere day and a half. He was assuming we would be walking 40 kilometers or 27 miles per day. Walking 27 miles each day with heavily overloaded packs and gravity 14% greater than we were used to on Earth. 60 clicks in a day and a half? You're not being a bit too ambitious, Captain?
No, sir. Don't worry, sir. The lads can handle it. We'll check in every 2 hours, and you can track our progress through the satellite.
I'll be tracking your progress closer than that, Captain. I'm going with you.
Sir? He asked, surprised.
I know I'm not one of you spec ops people, but I can handle a walk. There may be crucial decisions to be made real time when we raid the scavenger's base. I need to be there. Right there. Smythe avoided my eyes.
Sir, why else do you think I've been busting my ass training with you?
I'm going along. Don't worry. I'll stay out of your way during the assault. We're also bringing 2 civilians with us. Doctors. Medical doctors.
Sir?
Smythe's face revealed his anguish. 3 of his precious 28 billets would be taken up by non-combatants. That reduced his striking power to only 25. It was bad enough that I would be going with them. Smythe having to deal with his commanding officer looking over his shoulder and second-guessing him in real time. At least I was a soldier and had been in combat, including killing a Krestang warrior with my bare hands, or at least with the butt of a rifle. Bringing 2 civilians along would be nothing but a headache for him.
We have qualified medics.
His roster of 28 Spec Ops troops included 4 people with medical certification in addition to the battlefield first aid training that all Special Forces soldiers had taken.
Qualified medics, yes. These 2 doctors are experienced surgeons. They both did a tour with Doctors Without Borders. They've operated in primitive field conditions.
This is not open for discussion, Captain. I'm not going into combat against Krestang without means to keep wounded people alive until we can get them back to the Theranan Medical Facility aboard the Dutchman.
Yes, sir, he said tightly.
I could tell he thought I was endangering the primary mission, assaulting the Krestang, in favor of a dubious secondary objective. In combat against Krestang, both sides having equivalent technology, wounds were very likely to be fatal. Any medical assistance might well be a useless waste of resources. It may have been my lack of experience as a senior commander that caused me to bring 2 civilians along. A real colonel may have looked at the problem more objectively, been more coldly calculating about the lives of his soldiers. That wasn't me. Also, I figured that if needed, I could fight, and if 2 less soldiers were the difference between success and failure, then this entire mission was far too much risk, and I should call the whole thing off right now. The 2 doctors, Zheng and Tanaka, have been running and marching with us. You've met them. Smythe gave a curt nod, unconvinced. What he didn't say was that going out for a run or a long march was one thing, knowing a warm, dry cavern with a meal and hot chocolate was waiting for him at the end of the exercise. Being out in the field, one day after the next, marching with a heavy pack and the chilly rain with only maybe a tent roof as comfort at the end of a long day, it was a very different test of human endurance. Mental endurance. A civilian who had not actually experienced such bone weariness for days on end could not say with certainty they could stand up to such strain. He was right. I was taking a gamble that our 2 civilian scientist doctors could keep up with us. The Spec Ops troops and me would be carrying food, clothing, part of a tent, and other personal gear, in addition to weapons and parts of disassembled armor suits. The 2 civilians would only need to carry food, personal gear, and medical kits. One way or another, they would be keeping up with us. We weren't leaving anyone behind unless injury absolutely forced us to do that.
That leaves 25 billets for combat troops, he mused.
And 5 nationalities. Choose 5 people from each nation, I ordered. We can't have anyone thinking we're playing favorites.
Oh, my God. I was stunned. There, attached to the front of the RV, just below the left windshield in front of the driver, was a stuffed Barney, about a foot tall.
Sir, Captain Gomez, the leader of our ranger team, said, I categorically deny any and all knowledge of this outrageous act. That is, unless you like it.
Like it? I love it. Damn. Reminds me of my old Ham V back on Paradise. I'll ask you the same question I asked then. How the hell did you idiots get a Barney?
Gomez coughed.
Someone may have listened to your debriefing, and you may have mentioned your personal Ham V then. And that same someone may like to be prepared. I'm speculating, of course.
Of course. I stood back and admired it, then turned to the assembled team, my team, and saluted.
Thank you. This means a lot. I used to hate that Barney shit. Now, it's part of me, I guess.
Gomez smiled.
Instead of a Winnebago, this is our Barney Wego.
Barney Wego, I laughed. I like it. Captain, let's get this thing loaded and on the road. ASAP. Oh, man. I should have put some thought into what a road trip in a stolen RV across an alien landscape with a crew of high-speed spec ops people would be like. A Barney Wego lurched into movement. Everyone inside gave a hearty cheer and waved to the assembled crowd outside, and we were off. When we splashed across the stream and the canyon veered to the right, so we went out of sight of the cavern that had been our home, Smythe broke out into song. Pumping his fist in the air to encourage participation, he sang, The wheels on the bus go round and round. I joined in. It was fun. It built a sense of camaraderie. It set a good tone for the beginning of what was going to be a long, arduous journey. However, when the first song was done, the Indian team, who likely had been trying to think of a song most people in the RV knew or was simple enough to learn quickly, launched into 99 bottles of beer on the wall. And that was fun. For a while. Let me tell you, Spec Ops people are hyper-competitive. None of them wanted to stop it. The singing went on and on, to where we got down to 73 bottles of beer on the wall, and I, for one, was heartily sick of it. Of course, none of the Spec Ops people wanted to be the first to stop. They were way too damn competitive. The responsibility fell to me as the commander to mercifully kill the singing.
Stop. Quiet. What was that?
I stood up and walked behind the driver, using as an excuse a clanging sound against the bottom of the RV.
Sir, we're kicking up rocks here, the driver explained,
pointing out the windshield to the layer of rocks in the stream bed we were following down the canyon. There was another soft clang noise as the forward treads caught another stone and tossed it against the bottom of the RV. The plating of the Barney Wego was thicker on the bottom to protect against impacts. It also had kind of a skid plate for when the RV needed to slide over an obstacle. I called a brief halt and ducked outside to check the RV skin, partly out of genuine concern. There were some new scuff marks, no additional dents, nothing to worry about. When I got back inside, I was relieved to see people had broken out decks of cards and two games were getting started. Card games, even having nothing to gamble with except small pieces of candy people had smuggled in their personal gear, would keep people occupied. Occupied was good. The driver, a Chinese soldier named Zhang, put on some pop music, the rule being whoever was driving controlled the music selection. I couldn't understand the words, and remarked that pop music all over Earth sounded pretty much the same, so it didn't matter that I couldn't understand the lyrics. Captain Lee shrugged.
That song is Korean, sir. K-pop, we call it. We don't understand the words either.
Damn, what an interesting international crew we had aboard our Barney Wego, bouncing and lurching our way across the surface of an alien world almost 2,000 light years from home. It made me feel proud. Our first stream crossing was uneventful. Before the RV drove down the bank into the water, I ordered a halt and for everyone to get out so Skippy could drive the RV across remotely. The middle of the stream was just deep enough that the RV needed to deploy its flotation pontoons. They worked perfectly. The RV got to the other side, Skippy turned it around and drove it back to us. Then, half of us got back aboard, and our Chinese driver carefully took us across. He reported the transition between the RV driving on its treads to floating and using water jets was seamless. The RV's computer knew what to do, based on the driver's inputs to the controls. Captain Giraud drove the RV back to get the rest of us. Then we proceeded with an Indian soldier driving. That way, we now had three people with some experience. Damn good thing, too, because we had to cross our first major river in 2 days. After a couple hours, we stopped at a convenient place to switch drivers. Captain Smythe saw me looking longingly at the driver's seat.
"Would you like to have a go at it, sir?"
he asked. "Captain, I would love to drive this thing. I am not going to be some shithead officer who takes fun away from the troops. We'll be driving this RV for days. I can wait my turn." My policy that whoever was driving picked the music, or no music at all, led to an, let's say, interesting variety of musical styles. The first driver, a guy named Zhang, had played pop music I didn't recognize. It was at least recognizably pop. The second time a Chinese came up in the driver rotation, it was a guy named Chen. The music he played sounded like a cross between wind chimes, the kind of new-agey thing I expected people listen to at a yoga spa, and someone unsuccessfully trying to tune a guitar. After a while, I looked at Captain Lee, who shrugged, rolled his eyes, and we put headphones on to listen to our own music selections. Following Chen, it was the turn of an Indian paratrooper named Sharma, who liked to sing, loudly and badly, along with his music. His fellow paratroopers often joined in, off-key, but with enthusiasm. When one of our SEALs named Garcia started driving, it was across a relatively flat field, when the treads automatically adjusted themselves to be almost round, and we were making good time. The treads soaked up a surprising amount of bumps, so the jostling and bouncing in the cabin was a lot less than I'd expected. Garcia must have been feeling good, rolling happily along across an alien landscape in our stolen RV, because he changed his music selection in the middle of a song to go old, old school with Coolio. When the first notes of the song came over the speakers, the Chinese soldiers looked at each other and muttered something, and the Indian soldiers looked at each other and muttered something, and for a split second I feared we were going to have a problem. Then, the Indians, Chinese, and French all stood up, mockingly flashed gang signs, and sang along. Badly, with enthusiasm. As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I look at my life and realize there's nothing left. "Holy shit," I said under my breath. "Does everybody know that song?" Then Captain Smythe got up to join in, and soon everyone in the RV was going, "They've been spending most their lives living in the gangster's paradise." High fives went all around when the song ended. Damn, I thought, we really are one badass international team. Hopefully we could bring that cooperative team spirit back to Earth one day. The night after we stopped driving, the sky was cloudy but not raining. The wind had slowed to a gentle breeze, and for an early summer evening on Newark, it wasn't too cold. Smythe and I surprised the group by unrolling a screen and attaching it to the side of the RV so we could have movie night. Captain Chander of the Indian team provided a Bollywood hit movie. The Indians had all seen it before. The film was new to the rest of us. With our Z-phone earpieces translating for us, we were all able to understand the words without annoying subtitles. It was a pretty good movie, involving car chases, a forbidden love affair, gangsters, and something about diamond smuggling. Toward the end, I lost track of the complicated plot because I was so tired. The thing that made me sit up and take notice was that in the middle of a big fight scene, the characters all stopped fighting to break into an elaborate, choreographed song and dance routine. Minutes later, the music ended and they all went back to beating the crap out of each other. Gomez of the Ranger team expressed himself on behalf of most of us. When the fighting on the screen resumed, he shook his head as if he couldn't believe his eyes and said aloud, "What in the hell just happened?" The Indians all grinned and laughed, and Smythe responded with dry British humor, "Well, I suppose that's not any more strange than a Hollywood film where a car turns into a flying robot, isn't it?"